Today on Basic, Trevor Noah.
John was really wonderful, man. He was so gracious and he was fun and he was interesting. And one day he called me into his office. He took off his shoes. I was like, all right, this is clearly like white people things. and he said, what size are you? And I said, I'm size 11. And he was like, oh, try these on. I was like, oh, is this like a fitting? I was like, this is weird, whatever. And so I try to put my foot in the shoe. And I was like, no, I think they're too small. And he's like, ah, yeah. He's like, I'm an 8. And he said to me, I want you to remember that anytime somebody says you cannot fit into my shoes, understand that you have your own shoes to fill. Don't worry about mine.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Basic, the official podcast of the unofficial history of cable television. I'm Doug Herzog, a former TV executive, and we have even more moments of Zen headed your way.
And I'm Jen Chaney, TV critic for Vulture and New York Magazine, and I would like to welcome you to The Daily Show Podcast. This is actually not a Daily Show podcast, but it's starting to feel a little bit like one, right, Doug?
It is, isn't it? Jen, we've talked previously to Daily Show creators Madeline Smithberg and Liz Winstead. We also had a great conversation with Jon Stewart. And today we complete our Daily Show trilogy.
Or really four parts, because we had two parts with Jon.
That's true.
But that's because we are joined today by Trevor Noah, who in 2015, as many people know, replaced Jon Stewart as host of The Daily Show. It would have been a daunting task for anyone to step into the very big shoes of a departing cable legend. But then you consider what was happening in the world when Trevor took over.
Yeah, it was really crazy. Trump's presidential campaign was just getting underway, and that would be followed by the Trump administration that turned the news cycle into a nonstop barrage of dumpster fires. Between that and COVID and a lot of turmoil in the political arena in general, it was trial by fire for the young comedian from South Africa.
But Trevor found his footing and he made the show his own. And then last September, he shocked his audience by abruptly announcing that he planned to leave the show late last year.
We'll dive into all that and more during our conversation with Trevor.
And after our chat with Trevor, Doug and I will reconvene to discuss the major headlines of that conversation.
Trevor Noah, welcome to Basic. We're so thrilled to have you today. Thanks for coming.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. So, you know, Trevor, we always start the podcast off with a question we ask all our guests, which is, do you remember when you first saw cable television? Now, the majority of our guests are from the U.S., although Sam B is from Canada. We might have had another Canadian. But you are our first guest from outside of North America. And so I'm not even sure there was anything like cable television when you were growing up. But tell us about TV in South Africa and what it was like and what you were watching growing up.
Well, it's interesting. I guess, you know, TV in South Africa was maybe 20 years behind the U.S., you know, in how it was rolled out. So I remember growing up, we had three TV channels, and they were called TV1, TV2, and TV3. Very creative. And and those three channels catered to different parts of the population. Like they were almost broken down by language, by race, you know, because the country came out of apartheid, and one of the first things the National Broadcasting Corporation tried to do was create as much content as possible for all the different groups of people who had been left out for so long. So that's pretty much what I grew up with. Then at some point, there was a channel called Mnet, which was our first, I think, if I stand to be correct about it, that was probably our first like cable type, you know, television, but it was one channel. It was one channel and it was premium, and they had great sports. They would play a movie every Sunday and it was like a blockbuster movie. You know, they would have like Face Off. And then if you didn't watch it there, you'd only get to watch Face Off like 3 years later on the national broadcaster. But yeah, it was huge. So that was like my first exposure to it.
So correct me if anything I'm about to say is incorrect, but I believe from what I've read that you got involved in entertainment when you were pretty young. You were doing, you know, some radio, some acting, but it was, I believe, at the urging of a cousin that you actually got up on stage to do stand-up for the first time. Can you talk about that experience a little bit?
Well, it was, you know, everything was really wonderfully informal in South Africa when I started in the entertainment industry, you know, so we actually have a really good film and TV industry. You know, we don't have the funding, you know, to make the scale of production that you see in the US and maybe in other parts of the world. But we had really well-trained crews and pretty strong apparatus. you know, that worked on creating everything, you know, movies, television, series, documentary, whatever it needed to be. But the comedy scene was burgeoning. You know, stand-up comedy was relatively new. And I mean, it makes sense. You're in a country where you didn't have freedom of speech. It stands to reason that there wouldn't be stand-up comedy. So I would say maybe the second generation of like free comedians, as I always like to think of, like the, you know, they were the pioneers, a group of guys who, you know, I'm still friends with many of them today, who they started off the scene in South Africa. And then when I got into it, it was still pretty informal. You know, there were no comedy clubs. I don't think we have. People have tried to create comedy clubs, but I don't think we have one. You know, we'd have comedy nights at a venue, a bar, a restaurant, whatever it was. And that's how I got into it. You know, my cousin and my friend who I was living with at the time, they invited me to a show to come and watch stand-up with them. And at the show, you know, they just... One of the comedians sort of decided to open it up to the audience. And yeah, I jumped up and I guess I've been jumping up ever since.
And you had never given a thought to doing that before?
No, not at all. That's amazing. I was just like, no.
So I'm curious, before you became part of The Daily Show, did you watch The Daily Show? And what did you think?
No, I didn't.
You didn't?
No,
at all?
I before I joined The Daily Show, the only time I had seen The Daily Show was, so this was interesting. Once we got a few more channels, we would get a version of CNN called CNN International, which still runs today. And The Daily Show had a weekly version of, like, a cut down mixed version of The Daily Show on CNN International. I thought The Daily Show was a CNN show. I'm sure many other people around the world did as well. Right. So I thought Jon Stewart was a real news anchor.
Oh, that's interesting.
And I remember watching him one day, just like while CNN was, you know, you'd be watching CNN and it came on. And I was just like, man, this guy does not take his job seriously at all. I've never seen somebody. It's like, this guy is like, he's really just, wow. He's screwing around. I couldn't believe it. I was just like, damn, they have really weird news anchors in America. They don't care. And because it was CNN International, the rest of the news anchors weren't American. So you had like the Christian Amanpour's, you had news coming in from like Hong Kong, you had news from London, so it wasn't like CNN the way you think of it. It's a very different version of CNN in the rest of the world. We don't have punditry. There's no like boxes of people fighting each other. There isn't that. It's really just news. And so this guy stood out. You know, I almost feel like he wouldn't stand out as much in CNN in America, strangely enough. But for us, it was really an outlier. And I remember seeing it once and thinking, man, that person is, wow, he's out there. That was wild. And that was it. And that was the only idea I had had of the show. But I didn't get it. I didn't watch it because, like, the content, I was like, what? I don't know what's happening here. I don't know what any of these, who these people.
Yeah, you probably didn't know what he was even talking about.
Yeah, I don't know who these people are. I don't get the, you know.
But at some point, they must have seen your bootleg Zambian DVDs, because you got a call from The Daily Show about maybe coming aboard as a correspondent, and you were not interested originally, right?
Well, no, it's not that I wasn't interested. I got a call from John, and it's funny, I'll never forget where I was. And I don't know if it's because of how important the call was, or rather because of how weird the situation of the call was. I was starting my first UK tour ever, you know, and this was really exciting for me. I'd never toured internationally before this point. And here I had a tour going around the UK, and I mean the whole UK, everything from Newcastle to Brighton to London, Manchester, you name it. And my phone rings, and I was standing in Harrods. You know, it's a really high-end, strange department store that is notorious in the UK for being able to get you anything you want. If you have enough money, they can get you anything you want. And I did not have the money for anything I want, but I liked going and walking around inside it.
Did you ask them to get you a job on The Daily Show?
They have real full service there at Harrods.
They had an underwater scooter, is what they said, like a moped that goes underwater. Like, so you don't need any scuba equipment. And has its own oxygen. And I remember just standing in front of this thing, staring at it. And I think it was like $14,000. And I was trying to calculate how many years it would take me to be able to afford it. And I was just standing. And then my phone rings. And it's a random American number I didn't know. and it was John Stewart on the phone. And yeah, that the first conversation I had with him was me staring at this like luminous yellow underwater scooter while he was telling me about coming to join the Daily Show. And he was really cool and he was funny and he was, you know, didn't take himself too seriously. And, you know, he was, I remember the beginning and, you know, if you know John, you know how he is. He said, Trevor, how are you? You know, and if you know me, my name's John Stewart. And I was like, sorry, can you remind me? He's like, I host a show in America. It was called The Daily Show. And I was like, yeah, The Daily Show. I've heard of it. He's like, as you should, very important show. Very, you know, but with his name, he was like, you don't need to know who I am. It doesn't. And then with the show, he's like, you should know that. But he was joking. And I could hear this guy's joking. And we laughed and we just talked about life. And he's like, what are you up to? He's like, I saw your stand up. I think you're very funny. And would you like to come to America? And I was like, well, I come, I do shows. And he's like, would you like to join the TV show? And I said, well, it's a nice offer, but when and how? And he said, and he told me it was basically imminent. And I said, I unfortunately can't because I, you know, I have a tour that I've scheduled and I've just started touring. And he said to me, I'll never forget. He's like, I'm sorry, did you just turn down John Stewart, host of The Daily Show? And
he wasn't used to hearing that a lot in those days.
And I laughed and I said, yeah, I did. I'm sorry. And he said, no, he said, hey man, I get it. Kudos to you. And he said, I almost envy you because you're doing a thing that I've always wanted to do and never did, which is you're doing comedy in the world. And what is comedy like in the world and this whole thing? And he said, well, if you're ever in New York, look me up. And I said, I would. And that look me up, I think happened a year later. Mm-hmm. That's when I finally came to the US and I was doing shows out here. And then, yeah, that's when we met in person.
And then you decided to join at that point?
Still didn't decide to join. No, because I went in because I didn't know what the thing was.
Right.
Yeah.
So John said, why don't you come in, spend some time with us and, you know, let's see if you want to do something. And because I watched the show and I was like, this is not for me. I was like, what is this? You know? And as I said to him, I was like, with all due respect, this is not for me. And he said, well, I think it is. Just come in, hang out. We'll have a good time. Just come and hang out. Doesn't matter. If you do nothing, it's fine. And so I was doing shows at a place called the Bleecker Street Theater at the time. Mm-hmm. I was doing a one-man show there. And so then I came to the Daily Show and I hung out and I just sit around with these people while they would talk about, you know, just like a level of world I had never been privy to. I knew about the Senate and Congress but now people were talking about filibusters and, you know, budget subcommittees and House judiciaries. And I was like, I don't know what, I was like, who, what is this, a comedy show? What are we doing here? What is happening? And these people were so smart and they were just throwing around all these terms and the phrases I'd never heard before. And I was like, this is not. And then John would say something and everyone would laugh. And I was like, I don't know what he said. I don't know what this is. Clearly this is not for me. And then John and I hung out. And then we were just talking and he's like, what do you think of New York? What do you think of? And we just had this conversation as comedians and we laughed. I mean, like we laughed back, like him and I, we really laugh when we spend time together. And then he said, that's what we should do on the show. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, this conversation, we should put this on the show. And I was like, what do you mean? Just put this on? He said, this exact, we should create this and put it on the show. And we're having that conversation early in the week. And he said, let's do it this Thursday. And so that's what it was. And we sat down and then just basically worked on turning it into what we called a chat. And that was my first appearance on the show. I think if my memory serves me right, I think it was a Thursday. And
you and John on the set, right?
Yeah. And I appeared on the show with him. We did a chat and that was it. And I was like, that was really fun. Thank you very much. And goodbye. I had no interest in staying and being tied down. I was like, this is fun. I'll pop in when I pop in and I'll see you when I see you.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
And then cut to, I want to say, I think it's the fall of 15. I'm starting to have conversations about leaving. And we've been talking about this for a while. And he finally says, look, I'm going to leave. I don't want to tell anybody yet. We'll announce it after the first of the year. And so we couldn't go to work on sort of, you know, the next phase of the Daily Show until John announced. And I think he announced in February, maybe it was the fall of 14. Did he announce in February of 15?
Mm-hmm.
When did you start, Trevor? You started in 15?
I started in 15.
Yeah. So I'm sorry. So let me back that up. So John started talking to us in the fall of 14 and decided he was going to leave and wanted to announce it in early 15. So come February 15, John announces he's leaving The Daily Show, and we immediately start talking about who could be the next host.
And do you remember where you were?
I remember exactly the very first conversation. So,
no, I'm saying the day he announced.
Oh,
you remember where you were?
I do, and I wasn't there.
I remember it well. I remember very well for a couple of different reasons, which we could talk about offline. but I was, you know, I mean, I knew, look, you know, we had orchestrated this to announce it at a very specific time for a lot of, I can't remember all the reasons, but he finally announced in February, and we wanted to get onto the business of figuring out how to replace him, which was everybody's first question. Mm-hmm. And I do specifically remember the very first conversation we had about it with John. You know, so Michelle Gainless was the president of Comedy Central. I was her boss, you know, at what they call the Viacom Entertainment Group. And we certainly wanted John's input and John's support and John's thoughts. So we were down at John's office, Michelle and I, with John. And actually, his first piece of advice was his best piece of advice, which is, don't try and find another me, right? Don't try and, you know, find, you know, like that's a fool's errand. And he was absolutely right. You know, trying to find like the B-level version of Jon Stewart, you know, go find somebody different with a different voice and a different take and a different point of view. And, you know, it's time for a change. So we sat around and we threw out a couple of names, a couple of high profile names, and Trevor Noah, all of us. Michelle Gainless in particular, when you first started doing the show, she was the one that said, Doug, you got to watch this guy. He's unbelievable.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, he could be something. And she's really the one who sort of, you know, sort of got me tuned into you early on. But yeah, we all sort of simultaneously said, yeah, Trevor could do this. You know, he's never done it before. He'd be kind of green. It's you know, nobody knows who he is necessarily, but he's got we all felt like, you know, you had the tools. So more importantly, when did you first hear that Comedy Central might be interested in you to host The Daily Show?
I'm having dinner with you the moment John actually announces to people, you know, and not on air, but obviously the taping. I'm with you when he does that. I'm with you in Los Angeles. And then what happens is you come out to watch my show at the Improv in Irvine, right?
Let me set this up first. I get a call from your manager during the day saying, hey, Trevor's not feeling really well. He may not go on tonight. So I go, look, no problem. I'll figure out how to, because I hadn't seen you perform live and I just wanted to kind of meet you and get that going. And he's like,
yes,
you know, I go, no big deal. Just let me know. And then he calls me a couple hours ago. He goes, look, he's going to go on. I go, okay, I'm coming down.
Yeah, it was. So what happened was, I like for like a day and a half, 2 days maybe, I just had like a real tummy ache. I was like, oh man, I don't feel good. Yeah, I felt a little nauseous. It got worse. And I had this pain in my stomach. And then finally it got so bad. I spent most of my day keeled over, couldn't really breathe, couldn't cough, couldn't do anything. And I went to an emergency room. I was staying with a friend in Pasadena at the time. Went to the emergency room. They couldn't find anything wrong with me. They're like, it might be a stomach bug, might be food poisoning, whatever. They gave me a bunch of painkillers. They're like, there's nothing we can do. This is all we can do to help you, is give you the painkillers, go home, suck on ice, and then, you know, let us know if you feel any better. So I'm telling my manager, I'm like, I feel like death. He says, Doug Herzog is coming to see you tonight. Now, Doug Herzog is a very busy man, which is true of you. You're Doug Herzog. I mean, like,
I used to be Trevor. Everyone was, in the good old days.
Everyone, you're still Doug Herzog.
I'm the artist formerly known as.
Everyone was pulling you in every direction. And he goes, and Norm goes, hey, man, if you can't do it, don't do it. But it is not easy to get Doug Herzog to come to an improv comedy show in Irvine. And he goes, what do you think? And I said, you know what? I'll take the painkillers and let's hope for the best. And so I get driven down. I can't drive. That's how bad it was. I get driven down to Irvine. I'm in the back of this car. The whole, like, you know, when you're in so much pain that you're almost passing in and out, you know, and then there's the painkillers as well and all of this. I get backstage. I sit on a, I feel like I want to throw up. There's everything. Your body, I didn't know what was happening to me. I was really, really sick. I'm on a couch. I slept until showtime started. Opening act of the thing. I went out, performed almost only on adrenaline. Most comedians and some, like a lot of singers actually know what that's like. Performed purely on adrenaline. Did the show, come back. I'm almost collapsing. You know, you came by, said hi, thank you. You know, everything. Had a great show. I felt like death. Turns out, I didn't know this. My appendix had ruptured, but very odd, they're torn. It was a torn appendix. And so what happens, you know, when your appendix is torn is you know, it starts seeping into your body. It's really painful. It's a whole thing. But they clearly missed it in the scans and whatever. And so they didn't know. And so that's what I was just working through. Mm. That same appendix, Doug, and if you remember, when I first started hosting the show, burst in my, how many weeks had I been hosting?
Just a few.
Yeah, just like a few weeks in, same thing, same pain. And I was like, this is back again, the whole thing. And this time, a doctor in New York came, checked me out at the show, and he's like, hey, I think you have a burst appendix. And I was like, no, I would know, surely I've had this before. And he's like, no, I think you have to go get this checked out. And then I went to the hospital and it was burst, and then had the surgery, and then wanted to come back the very next day. Like, I didn't want to skip a day. And then you guys were like, no, stay in the hospital. I remember you and Michelle, everyone were like, no, just stay in the hospital. And so I didn't do a show that day. And then I came back the following day, I think.
That appendix should be like, you know, displayed in like the Daily Show offices or something.
Right.
It's a world famous appendix.
Yeah. But that was, it's just funny how that, like, that same appendix, that same involving you and then the John, and it's like all these pieces.
Well, I knew you weren't feeling well. I found out a little later, you know, that it was, you know, what was causing it. And I was even more impressed because it was a Sunday night. It was the last show of, I think, a weekend stand you were doing there. Full house. You did 90 minutes. No one would ever know the difference. You know, it was a great set. And yeah, you know, the show must go on, I guess.
Yep. And then to answer the long of the question, the first time I heard a whisper of this, I never heard Comedy Central was considering me. It was more, you know, people were putting out those lists. Who do they think will host next? And who could it be? And, you know, is Amy Schumer, Chris Rock, Tina Fey, Amy Poehler, you know, Who could it be? It was like all these names, like everything. Michael Che, which was like all these names. And then one random list was like Trevor Noah. It was the most random, arbitrary, like, what? Even I looked at it and I was like, what? It was so random. And then one day my manager called me. He's like, hey, would you? And I was like, well, would I what? What is this thing? This is crazy. And that's when we started the conversations about what would the what be. And then we sat down and I remember saying, I said, look, I would do a show, but I wouldn't do that John show. I think that thing was very much this person. And I not only would I not be able to do it, but I don't want to do it. Yeah. And then that was like, okay, well, let's sit down with Comedy Central and you know, and Viacom/Paramount/the whole MTV and let's see what we do. And then we sat down and we had a discussion. And that was the first time when I had an inkling of an idea that there was a possibility that maybe I would be considered to be the host of The Daily Show.
Do you remember getting an official offer and like what the circumstances were around that?
I remember when I got the call, I was in Dubai. I was doing shows in Dubai and I just finished one of my shows. And I was in the back of a taxi with my friends. And I got a call from my manager and he said, hey, he's like, how would you like to be the host of The Daily Show? I was like, wait, are you? And he said, yeah. He said, Comedy Central, they want to go with you. And that was, I mean, it was wild, you know. It was just like, you know, it's a life-changing moment. You don't forget where you are when it happens, what it means, what it doesn't mean. And it was interesting because I was with one of my best friends and producing partners, and we were standing in this venue in Dubai and there's music playing, and he turns to me and he says, I hope you realize this may be one of the last moments where you have a semblance of anonymity. Mm. And I was like, what do you mean? And he's like, I'm just saying, man, this thing could change your life in more ways than we think. And I was like, I don't know, you're overthinking it. We'll be fine. And then, you know, we all celebrated that night. And yeah, that was the night.
At that point, based on the conversations you've been having with Doug and folks at Comedy Central, you felt like, okay, they're going to let me put my mark on this. Like I have a sense.
Oh yeah. Jen, that's one thing that's the only reason I said yes. That's the only reason I thought of like considering it was what I loved was between Doug, Kent and Michelle, it's like we had this great conversation about what is it going to be. And one thing I really loved was, you know, Doug, you very, very blatantly said, hey, you can't do John. And we don't want somebody to try and do John. And I was like, I'm not trying to do John. This is not, you know, so we're all on the same page. This is great. And I said, I would love to do more international stories. I would love to try and bring the news of the world, which I read and I've always been influenced by, into the show. And I was like, is there space for this? And everyone said, yeah, we think there is.
And then as soon as it happened and the announcement got made, it almost got derailed.
it did indeed.
like instantaneously. Do you remember that? Do you remember that day?
How I can never forget it.
I think I'm the one. I was telling Jen before we started. So just to, you know, I'm sorry to do this to you, Trevor, but unfortunately to remind folks, some folks turned up some old Trevor jokes on the internet that they didn't particularly find appetizing. And there was a big hubbub around it. I think I remember texting you on, I think I still have the text chain on a Twitter DM where, you know, I let you know like, hey man, we may need to pull off a Twitter here for a minute.
Right.
And then anyway, the whole thing blew up, but I don't know. What was it like from your perspective?
It was really interesting from my perspective because what happened was, you know, the announcement was made and I think the first story was in the New York Times. I didn't interview for that. Then what happened was I remember I was moving on for the next leg of my tour. We're traveling from Dubai to Oman. And on the way to the airport, my friend Ryan turns to me and he goes, hey man, this guy on Twitter who's really coming after you, he's really angry and he's saying you're anti-Semitic and you're misogynistic and you're racist and you're everything. And I was like, well, I'm not that. I was like, whatever, it's Twitter. People say anything. And he's like, no, man, this guy's like, he's really trying to pick up some steam here. He seems like he's coming for you. And I was like, look, well, I mean, I'm a comedian, you know, it's like comedians say crazy shit and I'm like, whatever. And I really brushed it off and we flew and we landed in Oman and we slept. And the next day we woke up. And I remember walking into the lobby of the hotel and one of the guys, there was a man who was mopping the floor and he turned to me and he said, hey, you're the guy from CNN. And I was like, no, Comedy Central. And he said, no, CNN. I said, no, Comedy Central. And he said, no, you're on CNN. And he pointed, and literally my face was on CNN.
Wow.
And they were having a discussion about my tweets, and it was, and I'm standing there, I'm like, is you, your mind goes through, is this a prank? What is happening? What's going, that's CNN. That's my face. What are they? And it's on mute. So I don't even know what's happening. You're just seeing that, you know, I was like, wait, what is going on here? And that's when, you know, now we started picking up, and then opened up my, you know, and that's the thing with time differences. You open up your email and now you've got hundreds of missed everythings, calls, texts, messages, everything. My world has turned upside down. And Doug, you were like, hey, are you seeing this? And it was the whole thing. And it was just wild. And I remember sitting with my people. I was like, well, what is going on here? And it was just a storm, Doug. And I mean, you remember it was a huge.
It was a storm. It was a storm. But we moved through it. You know, we just put our heads down and said, you know, we didn't necessarily agree with. Look, I would say to you honestly, Trevor, the only thing that really struck me at the time was like, they're not great jokes. Like, it certainly wasn't your best material. So that was.
Well, you see, and this is the thing that got me. I remember talking to Jabuki Young White, you know, just before he joined The Daily Show. And he's really prolific online. He's great on Twitter and he's a fantastic comedian. And he's like a, you know, of a new generation of comedian. I love seeing like the shifts. And we were talking about stuff online. And he said to me, and he says, what's not just me as Trevor, he's like, what screws you up and a lot of older people is you don't understand the nature of the internet the way we do as young people now, in that this generation, because like Jabuki and I guess are both millennials, but on either end of the spectrum. And he said, we see things as being, it's the context is really important. And so the post only needs to be as up for as long as the context remains, and then the post can go away.
You know, ironically, despite the misstep with, you know, around the Twitter thing, one of the many reasons we were interested in having you host the show beyond your talents and, you know, your comedic skills and political insights and everything else and an amazing poise was your grasp of social media and what was going on out there in the digital world, which with all due respect was not something John was interested in at all in those days.
Oh yeah. He'd said it out loud as well.
Yeah.
John was so like, he
didn't want to participate. And we just thought going forward, this is going to be really important. And it's going to be really important to have a host who understands mobile, right?
Right.
And digital and social media. Which I think you do really, you know, I think you brought a lot of that to the show.
Just real quick. I don't want to belabor this or anything, but this is a rare opportunity for me to ask both the talent and the executive, like what the conversations were about that behind the scenes. And was there ever a point where you were like, gosh, I don't know if we can keep Trevor because of this, or did you feel pretty strongly?
No, I mean, you know, no, you know, we were upset about it. You know, people were sort of threw people for a loop, but we were like, no, this is our guy. We thought they were throwaway, you know, jokes on an infant Twitter. You know, Trevor, by the way, when he posted these things was probably in his early 20s, I think, or maybe mid-20s
like
at best.
5-6 years.
Yeah, he's a young guy out there, you know, throwing jokes out in the world, which is what you do as a comedian. And we were like, no, this is our guy, and we're going to weather the storm. We're going to stand by this. And we put our heads down, and, you know, it passed, and we went. And that was that. Mm-hmm. I don't think it ever, you could tell your side, Trevor, but I don't think it ever got to even any real discussions about, let's just lay low here for a minute and we'll get going. You know, John was still going to be around for a good part of a year, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. So. No, I think, I mean, on my side, I was ready. I even said to you, I was like, hey, if I need to walk away, I get it.
And we're like, nah.
Cause it's like, I can't lose what I don't have.
Right.
And I understood the fire that was coming in. I think the one thing we had, Jen, that was interesting was, and this is something we often don't have in a hot take society. We had context, you know, so I was talking to Doug and Michelle and to John and, you know, people going, wait, what's going on? So for instance, I remember like one of the tweets, this one always like bugged me because it was like, you want to talk about innocuous. There's a tweet where someone was like, oh, he's fat shaming women. And the tweet was, a woman had tweeted, she said, when a woman is loved, she becomes twice the woman she was before. And then I responded to that and I said, is this your way of admitting that you've gained too much weight? And people were like, oh, this is like, he's fat shaming her. what people didn't realize for context was that woman was my girlfriend. And we had had a conversation that morning about how we had both gained a ton of weight. We'd been having a great time. We're on vacation, all of it. And we're both like laughing and we're like, you know, poking fun at each other. And there was like literally like a love letter between the two of us on Twitter. And you don't, you don't consider it. It's public, but you're replying context. To somebody. You're having a private conversation. You don't think anyone else is part of it. And no one cared at that time, you know? Mm-hmm. And it was so interesting to me to see that, like, literally, but now I'm saying to Doug, I'm like, that's my girlfriend. That was my girlfriend, Doug. And Doug's like, wait, what?
By the way, from the Comedy Central standpoint, certainly from my standpoint, what, you know, Trevor's tweets were like, I mean, compared to the kind of battles I had already fought during my career for Beavis and Butthead or Matt and Trey on South Park or even John on The Daily Show or Daniel Tosh or just whatever it was.
Chappelle,
Anthony Jeselnik. I mean, you know, look, the world has changed and the way you look at the world, particularly for people who have jobs like I used to have. You know, we were maybe a little more cavalier about it than people are now, but our mm-hmm. bottom line was, is it funny and is it smart? And like I said, with all due respect to Trevor, like they were offhanded things.
Oh,
and
they were neither.
Yeah, they were neither. So that was our biggest concern.
I go like, judge me for a joke. Don't judge me for an idea of a joke.
But I mean, exactly.
This is to your point, Jen. This was like, it was a real conversation and I honestly think I was truly lucky that I knew these people and they knew me before this happened. Because I think, Doug, and maybe you'll correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think you would have been able to keep me or even wanted to had you not known me. You had known me behind the scenes with John. You had known me working on, like, there was a semblance of, like, I know this human being as well.
And that was Trevor's character was apparent from the moment we met him. You know, anybody who's worked with me over the years will tell you I had one rule about the workplace, which was no assholes allowed.
Yep. Zero asshole policy.
Zero asshole mm-hmm. policy. And, you know, I was like, no, this is a good guy. He's a young guy. And, you know, his greatest moment? No. But like we just move on and we figure it out. But which we should get to the figuring it out part, which came next as you stepped into arguably the biggest shoes possible on American television at the time.
Yeah. And you know what always liberated me was the fact that I never stepped into the shoes.
Right.
That was mm-hmm. probably one of the most amazing things that John ever did for me. After it was announced that I'd be hosting, it was obviously weird because it was a transition, but John was still there and I would be in the building at times and people didn't know how to deal with it. And is this the new guy? Is this the old guy? Is John now a lame duck? How does this work? And John was really wonderful, man. He was so gracious and he was fun and he was interesting. And one day he called me into his office and he said to me, he did two things that were really amazing. One, he took off his shoes. Remember, I walked in the office and he took off his shoes. And I was like, all right, this is clearly like white people things. And he said, what size are you? And I said, I'm size 11. And he was like, oh, try these on. I was like, oh, is this like a fitting? I was like, this is weird, whatever. And so I try to put my foot in the shoe. And I was like, no, I think they're too small. And he's like, ah, yeah. He's like, I'm an 8. And I was like, okay. I was like, in my head, I'm going, you know, the numbers exist for a reason. We didn't need to put, I didn't need to put my foot into your fresh shoe. It was just a weird, I was like, whatever. And then he said to me, truly, I mean, like, it's crazy. It's almost like this should be in a movie because it's like, it's not real life. And he said to me, I want you to remember that anytime somebody says you cannot fit into my shoes, understand that you have your own shoes to fill. Don't worry about mine. Hmm. And I didn't even appreciate it fully at the moment because no one had really been like coming for me at that moment. So I was just like, oh, that's really wonderful and lovely of you to say. And then the second thing he did was he took me over to his computer. He pulled up all the effusive articles about him leaving. And, well, John should never leave. He's the greatest and this. And he said, you see this? And I said, yep. And, you know, and then he pulled up the same journalists who had written the exact opposite articles years prior. John should leave. John's not funny. John is, you know, he's out of touch. I'm talking not the same outlets, the same exact writers and journalists who had written now how he could never leave and how TV, and yet they were the same ones. And he said to me, please remember that a lot of these people will be as fickle you know, as they need to be. Try to find your true north and just go from there. And he said, like, just remember this moment. Like, I've seen them hate me and I've seen them love me. So just try and find your true north. And those two moments became some of the most important pieces of wisdom that anyone could impart, because I needed them for the storm that was about to come, which was us jumping into the launching of the show.
Right. And it was a storm for a whole bunch of different reasons, particularly because that you were joining right as Trump was kind of, you know, running for office and things got, you know, a little nuts. And as a journalist myself, I actually interviewed Zubin Prang, who was your head writer.
Yeah, yeah.
Right after Trump was inaugurated, it was maybe like 2 or 3 weeks in. And I wanted to understand, like, how are you guys dealing with this? And it sounded like you were doing the same kind of, you know, general have a meeting in the morning, talk about stuff, but there was just an accelerated nature and everything could change on a dime based on what Trump said or did that day. Mm-hmm. And I remember him telling me that a lot of, in terms of making decisions, a lot of time it was, you know, coming down to you and like, what was your gut check about what to do? So in that kind of a chaotic environment, like how are you deciding, you know, what you should go with that night? Like what were your kind of guiding principles?
Well, I think to fully understand the context of how we get there, you know, you have to understand how we started off. So initially when the show started off, you know, and Doug, you remember this, the first part of it was, can we get this show running? Just can we do it? Mm-hmm. All right. Can this guy, you know, can he work with a camera? Can he help write a script? Can we do it? It was manic. And anyone who's done a Daily Show, and especially The Daily Show, which is such a unique beast because it deals with issues that aren't as light or aren't as easy to skim over as maybe, you know, another late night show, which is difficult for different reasons. Don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. But it's such a slog in that way. We were just trying to get it done. And now you're dealing with, oh, you know, this guy's, his accent is weird. He says controversy wrong. He, you know, literally we got hate mail about that. People were like, he needs to learn how to say controversy, because when Americans say what, controversy, is that it?
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. It was like all these, everything. And then people were complaining that people said we were racist because Ronnie Chang had a fake Asian accent. And we were like, no, that is how he speaks. And they were like, how dare you make an Asian man get on TV and put on that demeaning accent? And we were like, wait, this is his accent. Why are you saying it's demeaning? It was like what I call the woke boomerang. You know, it's where people think they're being so woke that they invariably end up becoming, you know, the shittiest person. And they would, you know, and then they were complaining that, oh, we were using a terrible prop idea of women being pregnant as funny when it's not funny, because we had Desi Leidick pretending to be pregnant. She was pregnant, you know? So it's like all these pieces were, I mean, it was just a barrage.
I love that they think everything is fake on television. Your accent, Ronnie Chang's accent, Desi's pregnancy.
But everything on the news, not fake at all. All of it's totally right.
Yeah. So this was us. Just, can you keep it going? 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 We just trying with, you know, we're scraping. We have a few pieces that do well. We, you know, it was really a grind. And I mean, Doug, you remember this.
It was a great, yeah. Yeah. It was a grind every day. Yeah. I mean, people don't understand how hard it is to do this show and how hard you were working to just keep your head above water in the early days.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I had to like throw out the ideas I had for the show and focus more on just keeping the show going at some point. Mm-hmm. And I'm eternally grateful because I had bosses who, they never made me feel like I was going to get canceled. They just went, just make the show. And Doug would always say the same thing. He'd say, Trevor, I remember when John was finding his footing. No one remembers this, but I remember it. So keep finding your footing. We're going to keep working. We're going to keep working. And we did. And so what happened, Jen, was, as you were saying, like, you know, Trump, we come in. This thing is bubbling, but it's not a real thing. There's always the crazy politicians before the real politicians really take over the race. Mm-hmm. There's just that moment. And I remember Trump was part of that. And my team would say, ah, don't worry. This guy, I was like, this guy looks like he's going to do well. And they were like, no. You'll get used to American politics, Trevor. This happens. We have a bunch of, you know, wild politicians that stick out before the race starts. They're going to disappear. They're the Herman Cains of this whole thing. Don't worry. Trump won't go any further. And I was like, oh, okay, it seems like he's going to go well. It seems like he's really good at this. And we were, we were just working, you know. So while America's gearing up for the 2016 election, we're gearing up just getting the Daily Show to where it needs to be. And again, timing was in my favor because we were at a place where we were able to sort of find enough of our footing just when the election was taking place. And that was chaos, to your point. But I do remember saying to the team the night of the election and the morning afterwards, I said, we now have a purpose. Mm-hmm. And what I meant by that was a lot of people felt like the Daily Show should only exist in a space of indignation and righteous rage. I mean, John, you always used to lament and say, like, whenever people would write like about their favorite moments, top 10 John Stewart moments, it was always him eviscerating. And he's like, you know, I told jokes as well, right? You know, I made people laugh. You know, he's a multifaceted human being. But those were the moments that I and understandably resonated with people. And so people had this idea that the Daily Show can only be that and it should be that. And so very early on, I think you remember this, Doug, people would complain and be like, Trevor's not angry enough.
Well, people were just complaining because you weren't Jon Stewart, which is
yeah.
a lot, you know, that was at the heart of it.
Yeah. They were like, where's his rage?
Yeah.
Where's his rage? And, you know.
Do you remember a moment where you felt like it all sort of came together for you or the show, or you felt like, okay, I got this. This is what I wanted to be. This is who I'm going to be here.
No, I don't think there was a moment. I think we had glimpses of that. You know, I think Trump as an African dictator was one of the first ones.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Because that was one of the first moments where, you know, the team did a really amazing job of helping me express my point of view. And my point of view was that Trump is a leader. It's just not the leader you're used to in America. So that was the first foray into me saying, I think your perspective on this is not wrong, but mine is different.
Right. Mm-hmm. And funny.
And yeah. And so that was like the first time I saw a glimpse of that.
That's a great bit.
You know, but then because of the nature of the Daily Show and it's daily, you know, with no fault to anyone, it's a machine and it's very hard to move a machine because a machine is constantly moving. You know, so it was trying to find more and more of those moments without letting the show itself slip. Mm-hmm. You know, so how do you find your point of view while you're also expressing it in real time?
I mean, I would make the argument, too, that everybody was doing, you know, righteous indignation all over the place on Twitter, on television, whatever. And one of the things I admire so much about you is just your sense of calm, your sense of, like Doug said earlier, poise.
Oh, thank you.
And I think in a lot of ways we needed that too.
Yes.
needed somebody to be that voice for us as well.
And a lot of these, you know, again, folks who were doing Daily Show-like stuff around the dial were also doing a fair amount of that. So I thought Trevor really separate himself from the crowd mm-hmm. in that regard.
Yeah, I do think without the context, though, what I realized was because people don't know me and didn't know me, rather, a lot of people interpreted that as apathy. Mm-hmm. You know, they go like, well, why are you so calm? This is why you can't have a non-American host. He doesn't care. He doesn't care about what's happening. He doesn't care about people. He doesn't care. And I was like, no, this is how I process. This is how I am in life. You right. know, if you mm-hmm. if you're ever in an airport and flights are canceled, you want to be with me. I don't panic. I don't stress. I don't shout at anybody. I'm like, you know.
Well, America became a place where a line was drawn on almost every topic. And you had to yeah. be either on one side of the topic or the other. You still do. And that's just not who you are. You have always been somebody who's willing to look at everything and both sides. And
right. And I'm not going to shout about it, really, is the thing. I mean, candidly, I think I also realized very quickly that, you know, it may be a luxury that you have when you're white. It's like, your anger and your rage isn't necessarily seen as threatening. Like right. when you grow up in a black community, you're not, you know, you're taught very early on, well, relax yourself with the rage, you know? Like if a cop right. pulls you over and you're white, you can be like, hey, I'm late for work, buddy. What's this all about? You know, as a black person, you can't show that you're angry that you're being delayed. It's like, no, mm-hmm. you have to put that in the back seat and focus on being as poised as possible. So, you know, it's definitely part of how I grew up, the world I grew up in, you know, right. how we were raised. So it's how you're processing what you're doing because you understand how you may be perceived. And that's just, it becomes an indelible part of who you are.
Sure, sure. And that's precisely the reason I would imagine that Doug and everyone else wanted to have you, because you were, again, you were different from John. You brought a whole different perspective to it.
Yep. And then COVID, which was, you know, I mean, it was one thing after another during the Trevor Noah era. But, you know, you got a lot of great attention, and I thought deservedly so, during COVID for really doing, I think, what most people thought was the best late night show from home. What was that like for you?
Initially, it was novel. Then it became fun. And then it was really just dystopian, you know. Because initially it was, I mean, like everyone else, was just like, oh, we're going to be here for 21 days, you know, maybe 4 weeks. Yeah, let's try something fun, make it interesting, see how we do it. So what happened was, when China was building the hospital overnight, like there was that 10,000-bed hospital that they were ramping up, and, you know, Spain and Italy were going through the worst of the pandemic initially. And I, you know, things started shutting down around the world. And I said to David Meyer, who's, you know, now the director of The Daily Show and one of my closest producing friends, I said to him, I was like, hey, Dave, do you think there's a way that we could shoot the show from home if we needed to? And he was like, well, I don't think we'd ever need to, but no. I was like, I think we need to figure out a way to do it. And I asked the team, and they were like, well, you can't. It's a whole TV show. You can't do it from home. And I was like, I think we should find a way to do it. And they're like, why? And I was like, well, because we might need to do it. And they're like, no, we won't. What do you mean we'll need to do it? I was like, well, I don't know. I was like, I think we just might need to do it. I'm just going to put it out there. What if America shuts down? And I remember people were like, America can't shut down. This is America. And I was like, okay. And again, maybe because I come from a country where it can get shut down. I was like, well, maybe we'll get, I'm just saying. And so, yeah. And then David just got to work on it. He was like, he just found tech solutions. Like, here's how we can make like a, you know, a home studio that uses few parts, and how we can do this together. And, you know, you'll have to be your own lighting guy, and I'll be the sound guy and camera and direct. And like, it's this whole, we're just going to have to find this whole, we're going to have to figure it out. Mm-hmm. And
you did.
Yeah. And that's, and within, we're figuring it out as we're going, but now there's no audience. It's just you. It's, you know, and finding new ways to make the show. And now, you know, Jen Flans was just like, you know, really the general of this operation, making things happen. And how do you keep a building together when there is no building and everybody's at home? And like the editors, I always say, like, they were the lifeblood of the show. I mean, they were putting in hours that they'd never put in before, you know, editing late into the night so we could get the show on. And it was like, people always say, but it was a team effort on another level. Everyone was pushed to their limit. Everyone, writers in isolation, you know, editors and producers working from home, their apartments have become their studios. You know, the correspondents, myself, we're all in our homes. Everyone was experiencing it in a very different way. And, you know, the one thing that kept me going was we were lucky enough to have jobs and to keep going. And so that's what we did.
Must be tough to do all that without getting the laughs.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I'm eternally grateful to New York City because I always felt like I was experiencing this thing with everybody. Like, right. I didn't leave. You know, I know a lot of people left New York. I know a lot of people went to other states or even just left the city of New York. I didn't, you know, every day I was here, you know, applauding at 7 p.m. with everyone else banging on pots and pans and, you know, taking the one walk a day where you would see, you know, the makeshift morgue at Central Park being built, or you would walk through the middle of Times Square and not see a single soul. I don't think I'll ever see that again. And I don't think anybody, you know, has ever seen that. But what it did was it connected me with people in a way that few things can. I knew we were all in it. I knew we were all in these
shared experience.
Yeah, we were all in it and all going through the exact same thing at the exact same time. We were all going through it, you know, and then it also just forced me to just be me at home. It's like, all right, well, I don't wear suits at home. I can't get a haircut because my barber can't get to me. It's like, well, welcome to Trevor. And let's, you know, let's just try to get through this thing.
I think we have to ask now about leaving The Daily Show. And if you could talk a little bit about that decision, because I think it surprised a lot of people, just to put it mildly.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, just like any departure, that in my opinion is timed correctly or done at the right time. People should be and would be surprised, you know. Mm. Any good journey that comes to an end, I find is surprising. You know, it's the journeys that aren't good that don't surprise people. You know, and when someone's like, oh, they leave. Oh, yeah, I'm not surprised. It's like, oh, boy, you know, mm-hmm. I'm, you know, I think like John, I'd been on my journey, you know, and I always say to people, COVID was multiple years in a few years. And I don't think just for me at The Daily Show, I think for everybody in the world, you know, we accelerated everything and we paused every other thing. And so it was quite the experience. And I'd already been talking to the network about what the future would bring. What would we do? What would I do beyond The Daily Show? Was there a beyond The Daily Show? You know, because I knew from the very beginning, I was like, I don't think I'll be here forever. I remember at the beginning, Doug, when people would say, John did it for 16 years. Do you see it doing for 16? I was like, I haven't done
it's a long time.
Any one thing for 3 years. Mm-hmm. Like 16 years is a long time. So yeah, you know, I never saw myself as being someone who would just do this one thing forever. You know, the timing became the timing. It was like the when does everything happen? Why is it going to happen? You know, and so after talking to a bunch of people, I realized, all right, well, this would be the time.
Mm-hmm. There you go. I always saw you as somewhat restless. I never thought in my mind that you were going to be a 16-year person. And 7 years passed in a flash.
Yeah, it does feel like you just started.
Although, as you said, it was like dog years between Trump and COVID. And So, I think, you know, you get in and you get out while you're still feeling good about everything. And you've got more to say on in a lot of different ways on different platforms. And, you know, we look forward to hearing that going forward.
I think also that's again where John, you know, one thing I've always appreciated in life is wisdom, because wisdom is an experience that somebody has had and then basically has it on your behalf. You don't have to go through it. John said a few things that stuck with me. He said some of them publicly as well. John said when he left the show, he was angry and he was tired, you know, and he said this. He said to me, you'll know when you're tired and you'll know when, you know, you start to become frustrated by either the cyclical nature of American news or, you know, the pantomime of what happens. He said, you'll know. And he said, but don't stay until you're tired. Like, don't get to the point where you don't want to do it. You know, John has talked about publicly about how he knew that he had to leave because he didn't want to do things anymore. He's like, I don't want to do that. You know, and he was really wonderful in saying to me, hey, you will know, but do it when you know, as opposed to waiting too long and then now resenting it or feeling like you're trapped in it or what. No, you don't want to ever have to escape The Daily Show. It's a beautiful gift. It's a wonderful opportunity. You don't ever want to escape it. And so like any good relationship, you know, I think you should know, if you feel like it's coming to an end, you should be able to know how to end that, as opposed to becoming this resentful force that now makes it end. And so, yeah, I was like, till my very last show, I had energy, I had joy, I had peace. I had, you still want to have that little bit of you that's like, I could do a little bit more. I could do a little bit more. But as we'd always say with my friends, you know, when we play soccer together is, when you're tired and you think you could do 15 more minutes, that's when you get injured.
Yeah, exactly.
Just walk away going, oh man, we could have done 15 more. We could have done, well, but you know what? Now you can do 15 more because you didn't do 15 more.
Trevor, you've been incredibly generous with your time. It was great having you. We have a traditional final question, and I'm going to have to switch it up for you, I think, because you didn't have cable TV growing up. We generally ask people, what's their favorite cable show of all time? But I will just simply ask you, unless you have a favorite cable show, what's your favorite television show of all time?
What is your favorite cable show of all time?
Or your favorite TV show.
It's interesting because your cable shows, if I understand correctly, you're basically saying are not the network shows,
Not the network shows. Like, yeah, right. So MTV, Comedy Central, CNN, ESPN, Lifetime, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, no, we got it all on one thing and in one place. Then if I have a favorite, I do have my favorite cable show of all time is South Park by far.
Oh, there you go. Nice.
We're having Matt and Trey will our guests here as well. So our listeners can look forward to that. But Trevor Noah, congratulations on a tremendous run of The Daily Show. Thank you so much for being here today. And we look forward to seeing you soon.
Thank you so much, Trevor.
Thank you so much, everybody. Thank you for the time. I appreciate you.
So I found Trevor Noah to be incredibly thoughtful, really giving us long and considered answers to our questions. I don't mean long in a bad way. Just, you know, he really had a lot of thoughts that he wanted to share. And there's a couple things that stand out to me. One is just, you know, that he got this gig in a lot of ways without being as tested maybe as some other comedians might have been, at least in the U.S. Obviously, he had great experience as a comedian, but he'd only had a little bit of experience on The Daily Show. And the fact that you all saw something in him is impressive, and that you went with him. And then the conversation that we had about the whole Twitter flap, like, these kinds of things happen a lot. And it was really, for me as an observer, educational to hear you both talk through what was going through your minds when this all bubbled up. And I feel like that was, what, 2015? And that's not that long ago, but I do feel like the way that it would be handled now might not be the same as you would have handled it back then.
That, I think that's true. But let me go back to your first point. You know, let's be honest. He was completely unknown and untested when we gave him the job, and there wasn't much to go on. You know, there was really just a handful of Daily Show appearances. We were looking at, you know, his stand up. I had gone to see him do his stand up live. There's, you know, some stuff on YouTube you can check out. Some other hosty type things he did back in South Africa, but. You know, it was largely a gut decision, which was he checked a lot of boxes. We thought he could do it. We thought he had all the tools. You know, if this were baseball, you know, I think you would refer to Trevor as a five-tool player. You know, he can kind of do it all. He brings a lot of the intangibles to the job, which I think, you know, really go unnoticed if you've never worked on a show like this, just how hard it is and what's required from somebody like Trevor or Jon Stewart or Stephen Colbert or whoever it is, honestly. And, you know, we took a chance, but, you know, was it risky? Yeah. Did I believe he could do it? Absolutely. And, you know, without trying to boast, you know, I had learned over the years to try and, you know, at MTV and Comedy Central and cable in the early days, we didn't have any money. Big stars didn't want to work with us. We had to go find our own talent and develop them. And so I just had a lot of trust in instincts in terms of spotting talent and giving them the shot and see if, you know, they could get there. And I really thought he was up to it. And, you know, he absolutely was. I think he proved that over and over. As to the Twitter fiasco, well, it was a slightly different day. My sense was, you know, he's not that guy. I had gotten to know him a little bit and spent some time trying to figure him out. And I think you just heard on this podcast, he's a really, as you said, very thoughtful, deep thinker. And I honestly believe like a really good guy. So if I'm being honest, what really bothered me the most, and this was a different day, was that the jokes weren't that good. And, you know, this in an era that preceded the era that we are in now, we were a little more cavalier in how we programmed comedy, and we always were like, you know, it's got to be funny first. And so we just wanted him to be funny first. That's why we hired him. And I was like, wow, those jokes, you know, they're not good, and they're mm-hmm. not well thought out, and yeah, they're a little icky. But we thought he was the person to host the show, and we decided we were going to stick with him, and the storm passed. Might have been a different thing in 2022 or 2023.
Yeah, although as Trevor explained, you know, the fact that they weren't really well thought out jokes was exactly what he was doing. He was experimenting. He was a kid, kind of, and like that's what people did on Twitter back in the early days.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting how he described how he used Twitter, and people were kind of using Twitter way back when, you know, because they were discovered in 2015, but I think they were written in like 2009
or something.
12 or even, yeah, maybe even farther.
I think they were earlier.
Or even earlier, yeah. So, yeah, it was interesting that he gave that all, you know, kind of context. You know, the other interesting thing about finding a new host of The Daily Show post-John was, you know, there were a lot of big names in the news, some accurate, some inaccurate. But what I can tell you is there were a lot of folks out there who wanted to be asked, just to say they were asked, mm-hmm. but had no intention of doing it. Mm-hmm. And my larger sense was most people who had a name or a career or, you know, had, you know, were those marquee names in comedy, there was nothing to gain by replacing Jon Stewart, right? Like that very, very big. Whereas Trevor had everything to gain, mm-hmm. right? If he struck out and then nobody remembered who he was, big deal. That's, you know, he's no worse off. And he took the gamble and stepped into those shoes and pulled it off. And now everybody knows Trevor Noah's name.
Right.
And he's selling out arenas all over the world. So yeah. It all worked out.
I hope this doesn't put you on the spot, but I do want to ask you one question, which is,
sure.
I'm just curious, like when you're talking about going by your gut instinct with regard to talent or programming decisions, do you feel like TV executives can still do that in this particular moment when everything feels so fraught? Are they just like looking at like a million pieces of data and like second guessing what people are saying on social media and all that kind of stuff?
Well, that's a really fair question and a good question, Jen. I not having been in these buildings for 5 years and actually 5 years plus now, I don't know that, you know, what I'm going to say is completely accurate. My guess is they know it's there's less reliance on, you know, sort of like that old school golden gut thing, which is the era I grew up in.
Right.
I can, and I really do feel like, you know, people who operated the way I did, you know, were in decline or not there anymore, and that there's a greater reliance on data and information and analytics. And by the way, those are all great tools. They can be helpful in making a decision. I'm an old school kind of guy, you know, sort of a get off my lawn guy, and that I believe ultimately it's always about great people, great ideas, great people, and their ability to execute against that. And that nothing replaces that. Like no amount of research, no chatbot thing or AI or deep fakes or whatever you want. Maybe they get there one day, and they might. Technology is amazing, but I don't think anybody or anything ever replaces pure sort of human inspiration. But again, sure. That's just me.
Right. Although I will say, I do believe Megan could run a network. I think she would be a really good executive. I think she would be very creative. But, you know, we're not there yet.
We're not there yet. We're getting there. You know, I will give you one fun fact, which admits the many names that were mentioned as potential John Stewart replacements. Chris Rock's name came up quite a few times. And the truth is, Chris Rock's people did call me. But what they pitched was Chris doing it short term. At that point, I think it was just going to be through the election of 2016. So I actually turned that down because I felt like, you know, we needed to find the host, get settled, get set, and not have an interim period where there was still going to be more speculation and Chris was only going to be there for a minute. But it was very enticing. I'm a huge, huge Chris Rock fan. And it was not easy to turn down that offer.
I would imagine. And in retrospect, it seems even smarter, only because right after the 2016 election, the news got even more bananas and you would have wanted some stability.
Yeah.
Not to have Chris leaving at that point and then trying to figure out who to go with next.
Yeah, that's actually a good point. I mean, I don't think anybody, I mean, Trevor, that was trial by fire between Trump and then COVID and George Floyd and just everything else that was happening. I mean, there was a real demarcation point, oddly, like John seemed to leave there was almost a period put to his whole era, including the news cycle. And and then a whole new thing started with Donald Trump.
Yeah. Good times.
Well, speaking of good times, we hope you had a good time listening to Trevor Noah. We enjoy talking to him, and we hope you will join us next time on Basic.
Basic is a Pantheon Media production in partnership with SiriusXM.
Hosted by Jen Chaney
and Doug Herzog.
Produced by Christian Swain and Peter Ferrioli.
Lindley Ehrlich is our assistant producer.
Sound design and music by Jerry Danielson.
Mixed and mastered by Brian Slusher.
Recorded and edited by Zach Spisner.
You can find Basic on Apple Podcasts, the SiriusXM app, Pandora, Stitcher, or wherever you like to listen. If you like the show, please rate, review, and share so other people can find us.
Don't forget to follow the show so you never miss an episode.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.